Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The enslavement of humans in the U.S. officially ended with the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863. But African Americans continued to bear the burden of the legacy long afterward. Jim Crow laws legalizing segregation, voter suppression, and real estate redlining all contributed to a history of an enduring race-based underclass. The idea of reparations for the 150 years of slavery has endured as well. From the 40 acres and a mule promise that never came to fruition to the present day, as scholars still study the concept and lawmakers start to take it seriously, in Congress and in states across the country. Hassan Kwame Jeffries is an associate professor of history at The Ohio State University, where he teaches courses on the civil rights and Black Power movement. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Anne.
You know, the conversation, I mentioned the 40 acres and a mule thing. Actually, the mule was added later, but the promise was never kept anyway. So there was an awareness at the time of the Emancipation Proclamation, after, during Reconstruction, that something was owed.
Oh, no, absolutely. You had a significant portion of the radical Republicans who understood that to emancipate 4 million people and move them into the free market economy without the means to sustain their own economic independence was essentially to create slavery by another name. But then at the same time, the majority of Northerners, and including radical Republicans, felt that, and this is where white supremacy becomes so important, they felt that African Americans would not work productively on their own. And so they consciously and purposefully worked against giving African Americans anything, any form of reparation, any form of payment for the free labor that they had done for the entirety of their lives.
When we talk about reparations, are we talking about cash payments, or is it more than that?
I think on the one hand, it can be much more. I think we have to look at it not simply as cash payments, but or really look at it as an investment in a portion of the American nation that has, for not only the period of slavery, but for the century plus, century and a half afterward, that have been the victims of not only discrimination on the private side, but also the public sector. So we have to think about it in really complex ways. So it's not just writing a check, although that would be nice. But there are many ways to think about how to redress this historic grievance.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the idea of reparations. Today, with me right now, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Associate Professor of History at Ohio State. Coming up, we're going to hear about really the expert, kind of the man, William Darity Jr. He's a professor of public policy at Duke University and a leading scholar on reparations. If you have a question or comment during this hour, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The very first reparations proposed were the 40 acres and a mule proposed by William T. Sherman, the same one that did the march through the South in 1865. What happened to that proposal? Because in its day, that would have been pretty good.
No, actually, in many ways, particularly along the Sea Islands, the coasts of Georgia and South Carolina, it actually goes through. In other words, as Sherman and others were liberating the Southland, if you will, and white landowners and former enslavers were fleeing, you actually had the transfer of land from that had been abandoned to formerly enslaved African Americans. I mean, so we actually see it happening, you know, Sherman's General Order 15 actually taking place. What the federal government then does in the years after that is take that land back. So there was a moment, small though it was, where there is a redistribution of land to the formerly enslaved folk who worked the very land that they had been enslaved on and thought that this was the way forward and continued to think that even after the land had been taken for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years after that, at any moment, there's going to be a union agent federal agents that's going to come in and give us the land that we feel and are entitled to. So for a moment, in some places, there is this transfer, and we see real production and productivity after that. But that window, that door is slammed shut pretty quickly.
And you're saying that it's the radical Northern Republicans that are behind this largely.
Yeah. So Southerners, former Confederates, obviously are opposed to it, right?
Yeah.
Because they still want to control African-American labor, whether they were enslaved or free. We want to control that labor. But most white Northerners, you know, believe in white supremacy as well. And because of that deep-seated belief in white supremacy, that led them to believe that African-Americans could not work productively on their own. And they wanted, principally, coming out of emancipation to enfranchise African-Americans, certainly, but mainly to jumpstart the Southern economy. And if they didn't feel that African-Americans could work on their own because they were too lazy and shiftless and all these other stereotypes that are tied to white supremacy, then redistributing land and putting land in their hands and saying, OK, go forth and work as yeoman farmers. They're like, that'll never happen. Now, there were some constitutional questions about whether or not you could
take land
and redistribute. But we just fought a civil war.
And the Southerners had very little power despite whatever they wanted to do.
Exactly.
It was the Northerners had the control.
Exactly. They had the control, but they did not have the political will. And that's the point. I mean, when you talk about, well, there were these constitutions. No. It was a lack of political will because of this belief that African-Americans would not work productively. And point number one, goal number one, was to jumpstart the Southern economy so they could jumpstart the national economy.
The United States has granted reparations to other groups. Mm-hmm. The Japanese people who were interned in the Japanese internment camps, the Tuskegee experiments, there was reparations to those people, but not to American Indians. That's another big group that has been left out of this conversation or the idea of this. What do we know about what the difference is and why them and not African Americans or American Indians, for that matter?
Well, I think it's a complicated and somewhat specific, dependent upon what group we're talking about and when. It's not like sort of for Japanese internment, right? As soon as the camps closed, they were like, oh, we did a terrible thing. You know, let's redress.
It didn't happen right away.
Exactly. So, I mean, you're talking about, you know, decades before of activism and protest, right? Like, this was unfair. This wasn't just. So, but I think undergirding it all, and Native Americans is somewhat different because you're also dealing with sort of sovereign states, right? And if you begin this sort of process of reparations, then is it pulling a thread and what unravels and how much do you have to give back? And, you know, I mean, so that there's this political question of sovereignty that is involved and wrapped up with Native Americans that people just don't want to deal with, right? Right or wrong, and I think it's unfair, we don't want to deal with it. But I think undergirding it all is this question of who is deserving. And that is both political and social, right? So we just, the Trump administration just cut two checks to farmers, right? For 16, we talked about checks before, right?
Yeah.
So $16 billion and then $13 billion or whatever it was to make up for lost income because of
the trade war
with China. Unnecessary, completely done, right? So we literally just cut $30 million checks because we feel as a nation that farmers, and although this goes mostly to these large corporate farmers, but small farmers, white farmers in the heartland are deserving of that sort of assistance. But when we think about African Americans, when we think about people of color, Native Americans, we don't consider them to be deserving of that type of support, even though the nation was responsible for the condition that led to the problem.
And that's so wrapped up in the racism that is endemic, you know, in our
Absolutely.
Country. And I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about the idea of reconciliation and where reparations play a role in that? I'm sort of fascinated by what happened in South Africa with the, you know, with the process that they went through after apartheid was abolished, and also what happened in Germany after World War II. And in both cases, it happened almost immediately, not like here.
Yeah, and that's important to recognize and acknowledge that when we're talking about sort of reparations for slavery, and, you know, in addition to sort of Jim Crow and racial discrimination that happens for a century and a half after, we have to keep in mind that because there has been this time gap, that it's hard to have reconciliation if you don't even know what you're supposed to be reconciling about. In other words, we do not do a good job of the truth part of really explaining to people, explaining to students, young people, all of us come through the education system. Well, what was slavery? And what was Jim Crow? And what was redlining? And what was racial terrorism? And what was so we can't get to reconciliation. We can't get to reparations until we get to reconciliation. We can't get to reconciliation until we get to the truth part. So we have a number of steps because people won't. What is it for? Right. If what was the big deal? What was the problem? You know, the reason why why white median household wealth is $139,000 and black household median household wealth is $13,000 is not because of redlining and racial discrimination and Jim Crow North and South. It's because of the refusal of African Americans to save money. Right. Like that's what we fall. And if that's what you think it is, then it's the personal failings of African Americans. Then you'll never get to the point of reconciliation and then certainly redress for past grievances.
The idea of reparations, other people think about that it can't be just cutting a check or it can't be a check. It has to be something different. Some people group quota systems and universities and that kind of a thing. And the whole idea of quotas as a form of reparation, or at least partially. So is it a mixture of things?
I mean, I think so. I mean, we could think creatively about it. What we're essentially talking about is an investment in a marginalized community, right? And how do we want to do that? Now, we can cut checks, right?
Obviously.
The thing with the farmers.
Exactly.
We could if we wanted to, right? I mean, so there's no reason, I think, for us to say, well, that should never be, right? That needs to be on the table as well. We could if we wanted to. But I think we have to think more holistically, and I think we have to think broadly to say what would be the best form of investment. And it's going to be multiple factors, right? I mean, it's not just going to simply be one tool, one shoe fits all, right? You take multiple approaches to thinking about the best way to address the persistent inequality and injustice that continues to impact African Americans. And I think if we look at it through that lens, then what we come up with will be very dependent upon place, dependent upon sort of socioeconomic status. But the point is to invest in a segment of the American population that has suffered tremendously so that the nation itself can benefit.
I think of just one person sometimes when I think of all of this, and that's Henrietta Lacks, the provider of Hilo, which is the cell that they've done so many cancer studies on, for decades went unnoticed until a writer, a journalist, discovered what had gone on and what she had done for the history of science and cancer research in the United States alone. Just one person.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so part of it is people not being receiving their just due for their contributions and sacrifices to the betterment of the nation, right? That is absolutely part of it. African-Americans working as enslaved laborers, African-Americans working in the fields and in industries, you know, literally helping to build this nation from the foundation.
And fighting in our wars.
Fighting in our wars, every single war, revolution forward, and never receiving their just due, never receiving fair compensation for their sacrifices. So that's part of it. But then there also, if we think about sort of a court of law, there are just grievances for discrimination and harm. Now, we have the smaller, we know the incidents of Rosewood and Tulsa, right? I mean, so the horrible racial massacres. But there is more broadly this sense of racial terror that African Americans have been living under since 1619, since the moment they landed on these shores. So it's part of it is fair compensation for contributions, Henrietta Lacks and so many others, labor, unpaid labor. But it's also payment for the horror, for the trauma, for the terror just as you would in a criminal court, say, you know what, there has been harm that has been done, and we can't erase the harm, but what can we do to sort of address it and with a meaningful financial investment or contribution or payment?
And do you think just something very contemporary, the physician from Ohio State University, people were traumatized by Strauss. They're seeking compensation for that trauma. It's as
absolutely
as prosaic as that. I mean,
right.
It's not anything.
No, it is.
Everybody feels.
Now,
yeah.
Now, some people will say, and you hear this with the reparations conversation, right? Well, that no amount of money, right? I find this funny, right? No amount of money can actually make up for the harm that was done. So any amount is an insult. Well, feel free to insult me. You wouldn't do that, right, to the victims of sexual assault, sexual abuse, right? You wouldn't say, well, there's not enough money that can, you know, can heal the damage that was done. Yeah, we know, we understand that. But what can you do to help folk get ahead, especially when the harm is continuing to happen?
And the other issue is sexual assault is never legal. For 150 years, the enslavement of humans was legal. Jim Crow's law made segregation legal. You know, it was an institutionalization of it. We're going to continue our conversation. We're going to bring in the leading scholar on reparations and the issue, William Darity Jr., professor of public policy at Duke University. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about the idea of reparations for the descendants of African Americans who were enslaved during the 150 years that slavery was legal in the United States, and all the ensuing years when things like Jim Crow legalized segregation, when redlining was overlooked, when voting rights were trampled upon for decades. Still with us is OSU historian Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He teaches courses on civil rights and Black Power movement. William Darity Jr. is a Samuel Dubois Cook and Distinguished Professor of Public Policy at Duke University. He's a leading scholar on the topic of reparations. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You are currently working on a proposal called Planning Committee for Reparations. What is it and how did it come to be?
The Reparations Planning Committee is a group of scholars who are working on the design of an actual reparations program. It was prompted in part by a series of exchanges that actually took place in social media on Twitter, where it became apparent to me that there was a need for scholarly intervention on the question of reparations and on the actual execution of a reparations program. In addition, in conjunction with Kirsten Mullen, I've recently completed a book on reparations, which will be available in April, called From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. And in the final chapter, we actually sketch a plan for reparations. But my feeling was that we had really offered a beginning, an opening volley, and so it would be helpful to have the Reparations Planning Committee actually design a more elaborate and extensive form of how the reparations program might actually look.
Why do you think the time is right to do this now?
Well, I think the time has always been right.
Okay.
Whether or not there's actually been a realistic opportunity to pursue a reparations program is another question.
Yeah.
But the time has been right for reparations for more than 150 years, from the point at which the formerly enslaved folk were promised 40 acres in land grants that they actually never received.
Gallup polls on this issue, and they're showing an increase in support for it. Whether or not it's cash reparations or what, how it manifests is a different story. But what do you think is changing in the American psyche that even though it's not a majority, but it's many more than there were even 10 years ago?
Well, even 20 years ago, because I believe when Michael Dawson and Ravana Popoff did a study some 20 years ago, they found that about 4% of all white Americans were supportive of reparations for black Americans. And today the figure is closer to 20%. So it's still not a majority, but there is a substantial change. The pendulum is moving in the right direction. And so why is that the case?
Yeah.
I think perhaps in the present moment, part of it is a greater receptiveness to dramatic programs for social change, bold programs for social change, on the part of the public at large in response to the Trump presidency. And then the other factor is there's very immediate access to visual evidence of police atrocities against unarmed blacks, because the videos are posted very quickly in the social media world. And so I think people are having a greater awareness of some of the injustices and atrocities that have been inflicted on black folks and are continue to be inflicted in the present moment.
It feels like an echo when you talk about the social media and the sense of immediacy we have around social media to what happened back in the 60s during the demonstrations when they were using dogs and fire hoses. And once that was broadcast to the country, public opinion started to change.
Yes. And I think that that's something that seems to be happening in the present moment, too.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with William Darity Jr., professor of public policy at Duke University, a leading scholar on the issue of reparations. Also with us, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, a historian from Ohio State University. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Keith in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Keith.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Good, thanks.
Great. I just find it amazing how America has given reparations to Japanese America, which we do, to the Jews of Germany, and these sort of things came out partly for the Jewish community, which we should have done. And we took into the bank and got them out of the hole, which we should have done, the farmers, and et cetera. And what we did was level the playing field for these people. But we refused to level the playing field for black America. I just find that just crazy and just full of hate. And like the speaker just said, only because they can't write a check, because they don't think they can do what needs to be done with our funding, we need to stop the madness. They need to be able to play for the black community.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries, you talked about that it's not that it's the will that's lacking, not the a way to do it.
Right. The will and the means are certainly there. It's a lack of political will, but then also that other point that it's a lack of seeing who or believing who is deserving. Yeah. Of this type of investment going forward.
Yeah, I would like to insert that I think that the key term is merit, that compensation for past injustices are fully merited by any group that has been subjected to those injustices. And I think that Black America's history experiences today have to be identified as being a situation that merits compensation.
For some people, it's the remoteness of it. Now we're a few generations beyond, and people think, well, haven't you gotten over it yet? When it came to the internment camp survivors, they were still alive, a lot of them, and certainly their immediate progeny was. What have you learned about how that plays a role in all of this, that we just wait so long?
I presume you mean, haven't we gotten over slavery?
Yes, I think some people, I'm not saying, yeah, I mean, I wonder that it's been so long can't we just get over it? Yes.
Yeah, but the case for reparations is not exclusively predicated on the injustices of slavery. It's predicated on the injustices of slavery as well as nearly 100 years of legal segregation in the United States, combined with the terroristic conditions that Hassan Jeffries was talking about, plus ongoing atrocities that include continued discrimination in employment, access to credit, housing, continued mass incarceration, continued executions of unarmed blacks by the police, and most important from my standpoint as an economist, the sustained racial wealth gap in the United States, which amounts to a situation in which black Americans constitute about 13% of the nation's population, but possess less than 3% of the nation's wealth. And that disparity, I think, is a vital index of the cumulative effects of all of these injustices, stemming from the period of slavery to the present moment. So it's not just slavery that's at stake. And in fact, had the formerly enslaved received the 40-acre land grants that they were promised, I suspect we would not be having this conversation today.
Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Don.
Hello. I was thinking about the call you have here and the subject. Reparations probably aren't the idea, as far as I can see. To give a poor analogy, you wouldn't give an orphan just money to spend and take care of his life. You try to get him a foster home. And more specifically, there was a town, I think, in Kansas or Oklahoma or someplace called Bowman, I think it was. It was an all-black town. There was no whites in it. It was so black, as a matter of fact, that the whites were afraid of it, and they actually burned the town down.
But what's your point, Don?
To give people community instead of money. The biggest thing that the Africans, I think, lost when they were put into slavery was their tribal community setting. And if they could have more community, that would be at least as good as any money and give them a whole lot more feeling of purpose and reason to go on instead of just giving them money or even an education. They need the community part, too, and there is no community. There's no Bowman, Kansas anymore.
Okay. Well, William Darity, Jr.?
So I want to take that comment seriously, apart from the smoldering paternalism and condescension that's embedded in it. It's interesting that, as Hassan Jeffries pointed out, there's a variety of cases in which other social groups that have been subjected to injustice actually receive monetary compensation to be used at their discretion. So I think in a similar fashion, the key for black Americans, particularly given the staggering racial wealth gap in the United States, is for us to receive the resources that will enable us to make our own choices and decisions about how to move forward in the society today. Unfortunately, in America and throughout the world, money is opportunity. And for a community that has been systematically denied the opportunity to acquire the same types of resources that other parts of the nation have acquired, the capacity to participate fully in American life really is contingent on a reparations program.
Charles in London, you're on the air. Hi, Charles.
Yes, I wanted to reinforce that point, and the previous caller unfortunately proves my point. That education about the extent of the atrocities, the historic atrocities, and the continuation of the oppression throughout the ages is the key. Because there's a lot of black Americans and white Americans that don't really understand the truly horrific things that have happened and continue to happen all the way up until the time of my parents' birth. And we even have a presidential candidate who furthered this horrible trope that somehow the banks, and I'm paraphrasing, not being able to be racist enough and continue redlining was the cause of the Great Recession. And any economist knows that it was the unregulation of credit default swaps and the disingenuous thirstiness of bankers who were, you know, didn't care. All they wanted to do was be able to bundle these mortgages into credits and sell them, and they were getting kickbacks. So they didn't care if the securities packages were viable or not. So like I say, to me, I think it's about the education, because you will have resentment if the education does not flow from a certain part of the population, and you know, and we need to come to the truth, which is what the professor said. And again, I'll take my response off the air, and thank you for accepting my call.
You bet, Charles. Thank you. Hassan Jeffries?
Well, I think Charles makes a great point with regard to, you know, we consider those who have wealth, sort of whiteness, wealthy whites, that they are somehow the most responsible. We'll cut them checks. We'll throw money at them hand over fist. But when it comes to people of color and to poor folk and marginalized folk, suddenly we have this great concern about their ability to manage money. There's no greater folk who have been able to manage money, to do more with less, to save, and we know this statistically, than black folk and poor folk. So I have no concern that an investment in the African-American community, that black folk would do well with that. And, of course, an investment in the black community is really an investment in America.
William Durity?
No, I don't have anything to add to that. I agree.
Let's see. Deborah in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I've been kind of trying to study racism for quite a while now, and I'm really stumped on the human-to-human aspects of it. And I would like your experts to, I am in favor of reparations. I'd love for your expert to talk about what if we were to magically distribute reparations throughout this country using whatever formula or system this group comes up with. Then what happens? How do we address the ongoing systemic racism that is so plugged into our country? And I just love to hear their thoughts on that.
Yeah. William Durity?
I've long been an advocate of the enactment of reparations through congressional action. I've long been a critic of the view that you inaugurate a reparations program through the judiciary or through judicial decision-making. This is something that has to be voted on and voted on favorably by the United States Congress. And for that to occur, there would have to be a significant amount of support for a reparations program throughout the United States. And so I think that that would happen in an environment where the kinds of resentments that the caller is talking about have become more diffuse and less concentrated in the American population. So for us to have a reparations program, we would have to have had a significant reduction in racial animosity in the first place.
We are going to take a break. My guests, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, an associate professor of history at Ohio State University, and also William Durity Jr., professor of public policy at Duke University, a leading scholar on reparations, which is the topic today, reparations for the enslavement of African-Americans and for decades after decades of racism in the form of Jim Crow's laws that legalized segregation, in the form of redlining, in the form of mass incarceration, and many forms. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Legalized slavery ended in the United States more than 150 years ago, but African Americans continued to be subjected to its legacy. Jim Crow laws that legalized segregation, voter suppression policies, redlining. We're talking about reparations for the institutionalized policies of discrimination. Still with us, William Durity Jr., professor of public policy at Duke University, a leading scholar on reparations, and also OSU historian Hassan Jeffries. He teaches courses on civil rights and black power movement. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. William Durity, the caller who said, okay, she supports reparations, hand out the money, do whatever that involves, but then what? How do we go after and get to that issue? What I felt like she was saying is reconciliation, and you're saying it sounded, when we left you with this, it could take a lot of time, because changing people's hearts is a lot different than, you know, changing their minds in the form of laws and that kind of a thing.
I'm not sure. I mean, this is, you know, I think things are moving quite rapidly in the present moment. I believe a near majority of millennials actually are in favor of reparations for Black Americans. And so, you know, there's all kinds of possibilities that might unfold over the course of the next decade. I think a signal about which direction things will take will be associated with the outcome of the 2020 election. I think a key question to be raised is whether or not there will be a change in the Senate, and whether or not Mitch McConnell and his ilk will be displaced. If they are not, then I would remain somewhat more pessimistic about the prospects for a reparations program. If the Congress is transformed by a change in the Senate, then I think the door is open for a more optimistic conversation about what the possible outcomes will be.
Do you feel like there's a prospect for reconciliation, the likes of, it won't be the likes of South Africa or Nuremberg trials in Germany because so much time has passed, but something like that?
So I like to use the term conciliation.
Okay.
Because reconciliation sounds like there was some point at which we were in concert in the past, but the systematic range of atrocities that have been visited on Black Americans don't suggest that there was any point where there was harmony between Black and white America.
Okay.
And so I think it's the enactment of a reparations program that would make the prospect of conciliation a realistic possibility. In the work that I've done, I've argued that a reparations initiative should accomplish three things. The first is acknowledgement. The second is redress. And the third is closure. And I think that this notion of conciliation is associated with the point of closure, mm-hmm. at which both parties reach an agreement that the debt has been paid. But the debt cannot be paid unless redress is enacted, the second step, where compensation is provided to the community that has been subjected to the atrocities.
Theodore, you're calling from Eugene, Oregon. Welcome, Theodore.
Hi. I had a question for Dr. Darity. It was specifically related to depossession, or the concept of it, and how that's been used over the years. If you remember from Twitter, there was a story about a group of brothers who their land had been passed down through them without a will, and the state basically found a way to take it. So you fast forward to the reparations discussion now, and I think much of the research shows that African Americans carry a lot more debt than most. How would the plan you're working on prevent, say, creditors from taking the redress that they get? So that's part number one. And follow up on that, number two, is for closure, like we've measured where African Americans are at right now, do we have a point where we're saying what predicts closure? Like, do they have to reach a certain point, income or debt-wise or whatever, before we say we have closure, to ensure that they get full reparations before we give closure?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
William Darity.
There are several questions there.
Yeah. Let's shoot for the depossession one first.
Okay, so this is really this is a combination of questions. One question, I think, concerns the debt overhang that Black Americans might possess in the present moment. And I think that apart from student debt among younger Black Americans, the major reason why Blacks have low wealth is because of their low asset position, not their low debt, their high debt position. So an objective of a reparations program would be to build Black assets up to a level at which black net worth would be equivalent to the average net worth that's held by all white households in the United States. And at the present moment, that differential is $800,000 per household. And so that's the gap that needs to be closed. And if we're going to talk about the issue of conciliation or closure, then I think that that is something that becomes a possibility after you have eliminated the racial wealth gap. That's the stage at which we can have a serious conversation about moving forward, not forgetting the atrocities, but not claiming any additional or further compensation for the past atrocities. In fact, no further claim would be made by black Americans for compensation at the closure moment unless new atrocities took place or old atrocities recurred.
Theodore, thanks for that call. What about the idea of symbolic reparations? Hassan Jeffries, statues, monuments, museums.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily categorize those as reparations, but I think they are the symbolism, the recognition of sort of past injustice.
The conciliation.
The conciliation aspect. Okay. I mean, we do need a public discussion, a public conversation, a public reimagining about what our symbols and what our statues and monuments say about both the past, the present, and the future. So I wouldn't necessarily, I see that as important and as essential as a part of this sort of truth-telling that we have to have, not so much that we don't repeat the past, but that we can disrupt the continuum of the past. But that's important, but it's not a substitute for the tangible things that Dr. Darity was talking about.
And William Darity, what are when we talk about the $800,000 number, is that across the board, or like, let's just take something that a lot of people are familiar with, you know, the women who were the focus in Hidden Figures, the famous book and movie, who helped launch John Glenn into space. Do they get more, or do is their legacy different than, you know, rank and file American?
You mean rank and file black American?
Black American, yeah. Okay. Sorry.
I don't think we have the capacity to provide laser-like precision about the kinds of atrocities that are relevant to each individual black American's lives. So in the work that we've been doing, we've tended to try to think about what the average impact has been and to try to structure a program of reparations that's based upon the average impact.
How does the seminary in New Jersey late last year set aside $27 million to pay reparations for its ties to slavery? I'm not sure exactly how they're going to do that and how that will manifest, but they're joining Rutgers and Princeton universities and kind of owning their ties to the slave trade. What are the implications of these acts on what you're working on, William Darity?
I find these acts to be morally attractive, but substantively marginal. That is to say, if the objective is to eliminate the racial wealth gap, or if one of the major objectives of a reparations program is to eliminate the racial wealth gap, then that will require at minimum $10 trillion in resources that need to be transferred to the black American community. So that these piecemeal attempts at reparations that are conducted by individual institutions or specific municipalities don't make much headway in accumulating the sum of resources that's required to eliminate the racial wealth gap. Moreover, there's the question of culpability. The culpable party here is the United States government because it maintained the legal and authority framework that permitted these atrocities to take place from the period of slavery into the period of emancipation. And so, so as a consequence, the focal point for reparations should be a demand that is directed at the United States government, It's fine if these individuals who are feeling a sense of guilt engage in certain kinds of acts of atonement, but that is not a reparations program, and it doesn't address the question of national responsibility rather than personal guilt.
Tommy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Tommy.
Good morning, Ms. Fisher, Mr. Jeffries, and Dr. Darity. I just want to say February 20th at 28th, I'll be 16.
Well, it's also Dr. Jeffries.
I didn't see a need for reparations. You know, cause I have a slogan, just treat me right today. You know, pay me today. Mm-hmm. But as I look at the larger scope of things, black men getting shot in their apartments, black elementary schools being inferior, foreigners come over here getting jobs first. As I look at the big picture now, I say, yeah, go. If you have to have a political, you know, a governmental enforcement of a pay us back, hey, go for it now, because I look at Somalians come over here, they're black face, you know they're minority, whatever, but you see a black, you see Muslim with that turban on their head working at Macy's when that should be a black woman working there. So for many years I just say no, just don't worry about reparations. Let's forgive and forget. But it was like I say about 55% of the Caucasian people living have that guilt trip of slavery back in the back of their minds. They don't talk about it, but they have that fear and that guilt trip about slavery in the back of their minds, and it's shown in their actions, it's in hiring practices. When you go to stores, they're half scared of you, so they have that guilt trip in the back of their mind. I say about 55% Caucasian people have that fear and have that guilt about slavery. Well, so for many years I say no, don't worry about paying me back. That's the end. Forget it. But I look at it, so white folks don't forgive themselves. Then we go ahead and pay us. Mm-hmm. I have a misdemeanor from way back in 1993. And I couldn't get it expunged. I say, now, Jesus Christ forgives, but white America don't forgive. So I guess Jesus Christ will have to judge America, white America. So I'm not bitter and not hateful, but if it has to be a legislation to pay us back, if that upgrade public school, black public schools, then go ahead and pay us. If it has to be a monetary thing, I say go for it. Many years I didn't say go for it, but now I do.
Well,
thanks for listening. Yeah. Y'all have a good day.
Tommy, thanks to you for calling. I appreciate it. We just have a few minutes left, but there are divisions within communities. There are questions about who this extends to, who would qualify for something like this. William Darity, what do you make of what Tommy just said in that regard?
In terms of the question of eligibility for reparations?
Yeah.
Yeah, so in the work that Kirsten Mullen and I have done, work that I've done with Dania Frank Francis, who's an economist at the University of Massachusetts at Boston, we've established two criteria for eligibility for reparations. The first is an individual will have to demonstrate that they have at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. And the second condition is that for at least 12 years before the enactment of a reparations program and or the enactment of a study commission for reparations, the individual would have self-identified as black, Negro, or African American on some official document. And what we've said, for example, is individuals could make their census self-report on race public information.
Why the self-identification? What's the relevance of that?
Well, there are many people in the United States who have lived their lives in white America as white Americans who will be able to demonstrate that they actually have an enslaved ancestor in the United States. And I certainly don't think if you have been able to live in the world as somebody who has been a white American, that you should receive reparations that are intended for black Americans.
William Darity, Jr., professor of public policy at Duke University, a leading scholar on reparations, I thank you so much for your time today and helping us get started on this conversation.
Thank you for having me here.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries, as always, associate professor of history at Ohio State. Thanks for your time as well.
Of course. Thank you, Ann.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. Thanks for those calls. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.